Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We've got no shortage of munitions. Our stockpiles of defensive and offensive weapons allow us to sustain this campaign as long as we need to. We have only just begun to fight.
The U.S. and Israeli war on Iran has entered a seventh day. The Trump administration says the war is just beginning. We'll go to Lebanon as Israel intensifies its attacks. After ordering the entire population of southern Lebanon, hundreds of thousands of people, to flee their homes. Israeli officials are threatening to turn southern Lebanon into another Gaza.
We are now on the northern border after the IDF instructed all residents of the area to evacuate. You wanted to bring hell upon us. You brought hell upon yourselves. The Dahya will look like Khan Yunus. Our northern residents will live in quiet, peace, and security.
Then President Trump fires Kristi Noem as head of Homeland Security after she was grilled by lawmakers over her record, from corruption allegations to the killing of U.S. citizens in Minneapolis. And finally, President Trump's hinting Cuba might be his next target after Iran. This weekend, Trump's hosting right-wing leaders from across Latin America as the U.S. deploys special forces to Ecuador. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives rejected a war powers resolution to rein in President Trump's ability to wage war against Iran. Four House Democrats joined nearly every Republican as the measure narrowly failed on a vote of 212 to 219. The vote came as the U.S. and Israel intensifies bomb attacks across Iran, and one day after the Senate similarly rejected a war powers resolution. Just two Republicans voted in favor of the House war powers resolution. This is its co-sponsor, Kentucky Republican Congress member Thomas Massie.
The president says we had to strike first because an Iranian strike was imminent. Meanwhile, the Department of Defense conceded there was no evidence of an imminent Iranian strike. Some told us this war was about nuclear weapons, but 6 months ago, we were assured our last strike on Iran decimated their nuclear program. So which is it? I think the most candid answer came from the Secretary of State, who told the press that Israel forced our hand and dragged us into this war again. And that truth is the very reason why it is Congress that must decide war.
In Iran, massive explosions shook the capital, Tehran, overnight as the city's 10 million residents endured the most intense night of bombing since the U.S. and Israel launched a joint attack Saturday. There were airstrikes reported near Tehran University, on an Iranian military academy, on government buildings and on civilian sites, including residential buildings, car parks and gas stations. Iran says more than 3,600 civilian sites across the country have been damaged in U.S.-Israeli attacks, including ambulances and two dozen medical facilities. Among the dead, according to Iran state media, 20 people killed and 30 injured in an attack on a residential area in the city of Shiraz. Meanwhile, Sri Lankan officials have evacuated more than 200 sailors from a second Iranian Navy ship off Sri Lanka's coast. The evacuation came after a U.S. submarine fired a torpedo to sink in an Iranian frigate that was unarmed and in international waters, killing 87 people. On Thursday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Iran is making a mistake if it believes the United States cannot sustain the war indefinitely.
We've got no shortage of munitions. Our stockpiles of defensive and offensive weapons allow us to sustain this campaign as long as we need to. We have only just begun to fight, and fight decisively.
Politico reports U.S. Central Command asked the Pentagon to send more military intelligence officers to its Florida headquarters to support operations against Iran for at least 100 days and likely through September. The Center for Strategic and International Studies reports the first 100 hours of U.S. attacks alone cost $3.7 billion. On Thursday, President Trump told Axios in an interview he needs to be personally involved in selecting Iran's next leader, just as he was in Venezuela. Axios reports Trump acknowledged Mojtaba Khamenei, son of the assassinated Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, as the most likely successor, while making clear he finds that outcome unacceptable. Iran is continuing to fire retaliatory missiles and drones at Israel and nations across the Middle East that host U.S. military bases. Iranian missiles crashed down across Tel Aviv earlier today, sparking a fire and damaging several buildings, though no injuries were reported. One missile reportedly struck near Ben Gurion Airport, which hosts U.S. aerial refueling tankers used in the war in Iran. In Iraq, a drone struck an airfield operated by a U.S. firm in the northern Kurdish region, causing a fire. Officials in Bahrain say an oil refinery fire from an Iranian missile strike has been contained. Meanwhile, Qatar has fully shut down natural gas liquefaction and won't be able to start operations for at least a month, adding to a growing energy crisis caused by the U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran. On Thursday, U.S. stocks dropped dramatically, with the Dow falling nearly 800 points, as oil prices made their largest weekly gain and the highest since President Trump took office, the highest weekly gain since 2020. Lebanon's health ministry reports 123 people have been killed and 683 wounded since Israel began a massive wave of attacks across much of Lebanon Monday. Among the dead are a 5-year-old girl and a 7-year-old boy killed when the Israeli army raided their home in the town of Mashkara. Over the past 24 hours, Israeli jets bombed southern and eastern Lebanese towns and southern suburbs of the capital, Beirut, after threatening residents to leave their homes or face death. On Thursday, Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, said that all of Beirut's southern suburbs will face devastation similar to Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip, which the Israeli military reduced to rubble.
We are now on the northern border after the IDF instructed all residents of the area to evacuate. You wanted to bring hell upon us? You brought hell upon yourselves. The Dahya will look like Khan Yunis. Our northern residents will live in quiet, peace, and security.
In the Gaza Strip, the World Health Organization warns stocks of essential medicines, trauma, and surgical supplies are running critically low, along with fuel needed to power medical equipment. The crisis exacerbated after Israel closed all border crossings in Gaza as it launched attacks on Iran Saturday. The Kerem Shalom crossing has since partially reopened, but most crossings remain shut. This is Amjad Al-Shawa, head of the Palestinian Non-Governmental Organizations Network in Gaza.
If the crossings remain closed and aid in all its forms is not allowed in, whether medical, food, shelter supplies, and other basic necessities for Palestinian citizens, at the forefront of the water sector and the maintenance of water networks, we will be facing a dangerous situation and a return to famine, maybe in a form worse than before.
Kristi Noem has been ousted from her position as Homeland Security Secretary. On Thursday, President Trump announced on social media he was firing Noem and replacing her with Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma. Mullen's an enrolled citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Noem had faced intensifying calls to resign or be impeached over her disastrous handling of Trump's immigration raids nationwide and the unchecked violent use of force by her federal agents, leading to the fatal shootings of at least four people, including U.S. citizens Renee Good and Alex Preti in Minneapolis, which Noem then falsely labeled. She labeled them as domestic terrorists. Noem was also widely accused of corruption. Last year, she was photographed wearing a gold Rolex Cosmograph Daytona that sells for about $50,000 as she toured El Salvador's notorious Secat megaprison, where Trump had deported hundreds of Venezuelan immigrants. She posed in front of an overcrowded cell where dozens of men imprisoned at Secat were seen wearing nothing but white shorts. Noam also oversaw a multi-million-dollar self-promotional DHS advertising campaign. Trump told Reuters in an exclusive interview Thursday he hadn't signed off on the $220 million campaign. We'll have more on Noam's ouster later in the broadcast. This all comes as the Department of Homeland Security remains under a partial shutdown after Senate Democrats blocked a Republican-led bill to fund DHS. Noam's firing was announced shortly before the vote. Earlier, Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut had reportedly said, quote, it might be easier for us to negotiate on DHS funding if Noam was fired. In Tennessee, a local Nashville journalist whose stories have been critical of ICE was arrested and detained by federal agents earlier this week. Estefania Maria Rodriguez Flores with the news outlet Nashville Noticias was reportedly taken during a traffic stop on Wednesday, despite the federal agents not having an arrest warrant. The Tennessean reported Rodriguez Flores is from Colombia, has lived in the U.S. since 2021 with a tourist visa and work permit as pending green card and asylum applications. She's also married to a U.S. citizen. In South Sudan, at least 169 people were killed after dozens of armed assailants attacked a town near the border with Sudan. Victims included government soldiers and nearly 100 civilians, with women and children among the dead. A UN mission said it was sheltering more than 1,000 civilians who fled the violence. A local official said the attackers were fighters aligned with Riek Machar, one of two rivals for control of South Sudan during the five-year civil war that officially ended in 2018 after an estimated 400,000 people died from the fighting. Meanwhile, the medical charity Doctors Without Borders says 26 of its workers remain unaccounted for a month after they fled attacks on two medical facilities in South Sudan's Jonglei state. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, more than 200 people were killed after heavy rains triggered a landslide at a major coltan mining site. About 70 children were reportedly among the victims. The Rubaya mines are controlled by the M23 rebel group, which disputed the government's death toll, claiming there had been a bombing at the mining site and that only five people were killed. Al Jazeera reports the Rubaya mine produces about 15% of the world's coltan, an essential metal that's processed into tantalum to manufacture smartphones, electric car batteries, and other devices. Child labor is rife at the mines, with workers facing what's been described as modern-day slavery conditions. And the civil rights pioneer Bernard Lafayette, who joined Freedom Rides and fought for voting rights in the Jim Crow South, has died at the age of 85. In the 1960s, Lafayette was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He later became a faculty member at Auburn University in Alabama, where he lectured on nonviolent social change. Democracy Now! Last spoke to Bernard Lafayette in 2020 when he described how a white mob beat Freedom Riders, including Jim Zwerg and John Lewis, at a Greyhound bus station in Montgomery, Alabama, in May 1961 as they were protesting segregated interstate travel.
Once we got to the bus station, all of the protection disappeared, and we were on the platform, and Jim Zwerg was beaten up, and John Lewis was clobbered, and I got kicked in the chest and had three broken ribs. So there was nothing you could do with broken ribs. So I went through the entire Freedom Rides with three broken ribs. I didn't tell my fellow Freedom Riders because they might have insisted that I not go. So I just kept quiet. I quietly suffered the entire trip.
Bernard Lafayette was 85 years old. And in Chicago today, family and friends of the Reverend Jesse Jackson are gathering for a memorial service celebrating the life and of the late civil rights leader who died in February at the age of 84. The service is open to the public. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The death toll in Iran has reached at least 1,300. as the U.S. and Israeli war enters a seventh day. Massive explosion shook the capital, Tehran, overnight as the city's 10 million residents endured the most intense night of bombing. Iran continues to retaliate by launching attacks on Israel and Gulf nations allied with the United States. On Thursday, President Trump told Axios he needs to be personally involved in selecting Iran's next leader, just as he was in Venezuela. Meanwhile, Israel's escalating attacks on Lebanon after ordering the entire population of southern Lebanon to flee or face death. In a video shared on Thursday, Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, threatened to turn areas of Lebanon into another Gaza.
We are now on the northern border after the IDF instructed all residents of the area to evacuate. You wanted to bring hell upon us. You brought hell upon yourselves. The Dahya will look like Khan Yunis. Our northern residents will live in quiet, peace and security.
Displaced residents of Lebanon say they've left everything behind without knowing when or if they will be able to return to their homes. This is Alia Hijazi, a mother of 10 who fled southern Lebanon.
They said they were going to strike Dahya, so we left, and here we are sitting in the street, like you can see. Now we don't know where we're supposed to go, where we should go, honestly. We don't have any shelter to stay. Brother, you know what I mean? I have 10 children. I don't know where my children are. They're displaced. I don't know where my children are. I have 4 sons and 6 daughters. Only this girl is with me. Me and my husband. I don't know about the others. Each one is staying somewhere different. Everyone is living, except us. We're not really living. I was 6 years old and I lived through the war in the 1971, 1982, and 2000-something. And it's still worse, worse, worse. When are we going to be done with wars? We're not going to be done. Brother, I swear we're not going to be done.
We go now to Beirut, where we're joined by Leila Younis. She's an investigative journalist and writer based in Beirut. Her new piece for Dropsite News is headlined Mass Expulsion in Lebanon as Israel Expands War. We don't know where to go. Leila, thanks so much for being with us. If you can start off by just describing what's happening on the ground as tens of thousands of people are told to leave their homes, the entire area of southern Lebanon, which also includes Tyre, the Lebanon's second largest city.
Yeah, so it all began on late Sunday night into Monday morning. It kind of the beginning of it was marked by 6 very loud airstrikes that shook Beirut, waking many of us up. And we all knew that the war here had escalated once again. Since then, Israel first issued evacuation warnings for 50 villages, then 80 villages, and then completely, you know, said we are evacuating all villages south of the Lidani River. And then yesterday, chaos once again when we heard that they're also issuing evacuation orders for Dahya. As you heard, the individuals who you just soundbited, you know, people are basically fleeing north with nowhere to go. Shelters are filling up rapidly. People are sleeping on the pavement in the winter nights. And it's completely unclear, you know, when this is going to end.
And also the Lebanese Prime Minister Nawaf Salam has actually said that any retaliation or military action by Hezbollah against Israel is not sanctioned by the government. Could you talk about the government's response to the Israeli attack?
Yeah, absolutely. So Nawaf Salam came into power after the 66 days of escalated fighting in the fall of 2024 on a mandate, really, to disarm Hezbollah in the south. And that mandate was, of course, coming from the U.S., which does fund the Lebanese army, as well as from the Gulf states. The hope, of course, is that, you know, the Americans and the Gulf states ultimately help fund not only the reconstruction of southern Lebanon, but Lebanon's been embroiled for years in the economic crisis since 2019. And so that investment has been promised to Lebanon on the condition that it disarms Hezbollah. So Nawaf Salam, along with his supporters, have tried very hard for the past year to kind of push this agenda. We've seen the army, along with the United Nations peacekeepers stationed in the south, release footage of, you know, Hezbollah tunnels that they've discovered, weapons storage sites that they intend to demolish. And yet, you know, what we're seeing here is quite a blow to those plans. Hezbollah clearly maintains a significant military capacity, even south of the Litani River. They are engaging in active fighting with the Israelis. They're shooting rockets towards Israel missile defense systems and so on. And so, you know, this obviously doesn't bode well for Nawaf's agenda. And I think that with this latest move, calling Hezbollah's acts in Lebanon illegal, even, you know, making claims, you know, saying that he now wants to start pursuing them, asking the army to even, you know, arrest people who are shooting rockets into Israel, is him kind of trying to signal to the international community that he continues to stand by that mandate. However, you know, we're hearing now from the Israelis and the Americans that they want more. They don't want symbolic actions, quote unquote, from the Lebanese government. They really want to see the army confront the Hezbollah, which is which is quite a daunting prospect, right? We're talking about, you know, what could look ultimately like a civil war if such a thing were to take place.
And what's your sense of the intention here of Israel? Are they actually going to try to occupy and hold Lebanese territory?
They've said that they intend to occupy at least 15 kilometers. They want to into southern Lebanon. We're talking about dozens of villages. And this is in addition to, I think it's really, really important to emphasize that Israel's already occupying land in southern Lebanon. After the 66 days of fighting, they occupied five different points within southern Lebanon. They're all up on hills from which they can send drones to surveil the people of the south. And so, you know, this is kind of in addition to what really has already been an occupation. They're now saying that they want to push in, they want to create a buffer zone. And so that is kind of their intention, whether or not they'll be able to do it. Of course, at this very moment, unclear. However, I should add that, you know, people of the South will tell you, I think the vast majority of them, they fear, even prior to all of these recent years of war, another occupation of southern Lebanon. It would not be the first. Southern Lebanon was occupied. It was a brutal occupation from the years of 1982 to 2000, liberation in 2000. And so people have that, the memory of that occupation, very fresh in their minds. In interviews that I had with people in the South, they've frequently point to what recently happened in Syria when the South of that country was disarmed following the fall of the Assad regime. You know, Israeli forces swept into the Golan Heights, took a lot more land, including land with very rich water resources, blew up homes, blocked people from their farmland. And so, you know, there's great, great fear among the people of the South that this is to be repeated again.
Arab and Muslim leaders, I want to talk about them. But first, earlier today, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, warned about the situation in Lebanon.
At the moment, with these blanket, massive displacement orders, we are talking here about hundreds and thousands of people. We, our colleagues on the ground, hear every day about the anguish that people face, about not knowing where to go, not knowing how long it will take. Obviously, this raises serious concern under international humanitarian law, and in particular when it comes to issues around forced transfer.
On to the human rights leader, Volker Turk's comments.
Sorry, Amy, I'm not sure
Layla,
I heard you.
Can you respond to Volker Turk's comments?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what he's saying, it's very clear that this is illegal. This is ultimately, I mean, you know, we're not talking about issuing a warning for a building. We're talking about issuing warnings for the evacuation of an entire massive segments of the country. I think the word on everyone's mouths here is ethnic cleansing. The southern suburbs alone are home to 500,000 people. Those people are all now fleeing north. And I'd like to tell you the story of one of them. In my article, I write about Mustafa Arut, who is the Mukhtar, another Arabic word for local leader of the village of Meisej Jabal on the border. You know, and he, I think the story of him and his young relatives is really one that I think encapsulates the situation very well, which is that, you know, he got the call to evacuate from the Israelis. He packs up with his family. He begins to head north in the middle of the night, nowhere to go. He gets to Saida. I talk to him when he's just reached Saida. That's taken him more than 12 hours on the road. He's fasting. It's Ramadan. He tells me that he's going to go perhaps to Deir Zaharane, which is a village that also has an evacuation order, promises no safety. That is where he ended up staying the night, despite an airstrike there. And then on the way there, he learns that two of his young relatives were killed. These two young relatives, Haidar and Ruqayya, ages 2 and 4, were actually already living displaced. They were living displaced in the village of Sultaniye in the south. And so they're living displaced because their home in Meisej Jabal was destroyed. And as they're picking up their things, their mother is carrying her children, about to leave the house and flee. And an Israeli airstrike, you know, hits this home of these displaced people. So you know, this idea, what the UN commissioner is saying is absolutely correct. I mean, this is a forced transfer. I mean, I think that even though we're seeing some people, like the people of the village of Alma Shaab, say we're not leaving, some people, the Dahi, saying we're not leaving, you know, the fact that this order is so sweeping means that Israel could potentially, you know, come and say, oh, well, if we, you know, if we kill civilians, well, we issued an order for them. So you know, we're not responsible for civilian deaths, which is ludicrous given, you know, the conditions here, the lack of housing and the fact that people are kind of being asked to mass flee an entire region of a country.
We're talking to Leila Younis on the ground in Beirut, Lebanon. We're also joined by Omar Shakir, the new executive director of Dawn. On Thursday, Dawn urged Iran to file a declaration granting the International Criminal Court jurisdiction over crimes committed in the U.S. and Israeli strikes on schools and hospitals. Omar's former Israel and Palestine director at Human Rights Watch. He's joining us from Amman, Jordan. This whole issue of international law, Omar, if you can talk about how it applies to what we're seeing with Israel and U.S.'s thousands of strikes on Iran, begun on Saturday, and the thousands of strikes on Lebanon, as we're just hearing Leila describe.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, there is more and more evidence emerging every single day of grave war crimes being carried out by the United States and Israel in Iran, in Lebanon, and across the region. International criminal law has developed mechanisms that can provide accountability for these crimes, but it requires states to take particular actions. So what Dawn is calling for now is for the Iranian government, as well as other affected states in the region, to file a declaration to give the International Criminal Court jurisdiction to look into serious crimes committed on their territory since February 28th. States do not need to be members of the International Court to file this declaration. In fact, both Ukraine and Palestine followed this particular route and ultimately ended up with the issuance of arrest warrants against perpetrators involved in the perpetration of very serious crimes. There is action these governments who have been claiming and citing war crimes abuses, they can't take these actions to provide a pathway to justice. They should also be securing evidence. They should be providing access to and engaging with human rights fact finders, including the UN Office of Human Rights that was cited earlier, as well as commissions of inquiries that currently exist for Israel, Palestine, and for Iran. So at the end of the day, the abuses we are seeing are harrowing, but there are mechanisms. The U.S. has no veto on those mechanisms. What is required is political will by these governments to ensure a pathway to accountability.
But Omar, some would say that, yes, the United States has no ability to veto, but it just simply has ignored international law and has faced really no consequences. So why should Iran even try to go through the formalities of these of requesting this kind of action by the international legal community?
Look, I think, one, if you look at other contexts around the world, the mere fact of arrest warrants can have a deterrent effect. Certainly in covering Israel-Palestine for many years, we've seen that reality. The only thing that has really led to any sort of Israeli government pullback has been the threat of accountability or action. For example, the Palestinian village of Khan al-Ahmar in the West Bank, one of the reasons why it has not been demolished and destroyed was that there was a warning issued by the International Criminal Court. And according to Israeli officials, after the fact, they noted that that served as a deterrent. We've also seen when action was taken by states in Europe and around the world around the EU-Israel trade agreement, we saw them ease up the restrictions on the blockade in Gaza. So ultimately, it's easy for us to be skeptical when we see what's happening in the world. And indeed, what we're seeing is very much a threat to the world, the rules-based international order. But that order still has tools available to it, but it requires actions to be taken by states. So we have reasons to be skeptical. But in the face of, you know, dozens of schoolgirls and teachers blown to pieces, in the face of again, more than a dozen attacks on hospitals in Iran, we're seeing the same playbook from Gaza there that led to a genocide being unfurled in Iran and in ways in Lebanon. But we have action that we can take, and it's critical that states take it. It may not stop the abuses, but it could have an effect. And at this point, what we need is action.
And what about this whole issue of the Trump